Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jackie Leonard, and in the early hours of Friday the 11th of October, these are our main stories. Turkish forces have captured a string of towns and villages in their assault on Kurdish-controlled areas of northern Syria. Also in this podcast...
She soaked soybeans overnight, crushed them and squeezed them with a cloth. This soybean extract was then mixed with water.
So why would a Japanese university student do this in preparation for an exam on ancient ninjas? More later. Turkish forces are reported to have captured a string of villages as they press ahead with their large-scale offensive against Kurdish fighters in northeastern Syria. Thursday was a day of Turkish air and artillery strikes, with much of the focus on two towns close to the frontier, Tal Abyad and Ras Al Ain. It's believed that the Turks intend to besiege these areas in order to avoid house-to-house fighting. More than 60,000 people are said to have fled the offensive, and the Kurds say 9 civilians have been killed. Towns on the Turkish side of the border have come under Kurdish fire. Turkey says it wants to create a safe zone cleared of Kurdish militias where Syrians currently given refuge in Turkey can be returned. Our correspondent Martin Patience is at the Turkey-Syria border from where he sent this report.
Along the border, Turkey pounded Kurdish targets just inside Syria. It included towns like Tal Abyad and Ras Al Ain, which are now reportedly encircled by the Turkish military. One Kurdish man accused Turkey of trying to wipe out the Kurds.
It's a genocidal campaign to exterminate the Kurds. It's bringing Arab settlers and Turkmen settlers. First of all, they target civilian centers. When the Syrian rebels who are affiliates of Turkey, they come, they loot and steal everything. Then they occupy your land.
He claimed Turkish-backed Syrian forces were targeting civilians, something denied by Ankara. But tens of thousands of civilians in Syria have fled the violence. Kurdish forces have vowed to stand and fight, and they're firing back. My colleague Orla Gurin was in the Turkish town of Akçakale when several mortars landed.
There have been 3 very loud blasts close to us. We could hear them. We could feel them, and instantly there were scenes of panic in the streets, of people running for their lives, others rushing towards the scene, trying to find out if there were casualties. Now, we know that there was at least one person injured. We saw them being taken away, and we could see on the ground the evidence of an artillery strike.
Turkish officials say 3 people were killed in the attack, including a 9-month-old Syrian baby. There were also reports of several civilian casualties in northern Syria. But in Turkey, there is widespread support for this operation. A tribal chief at the border hailed it as a great day for Turkey. He said it would mean Syrian refugees could go back home and that he supported everything President Erdogan does. Now that the offensive has started, Turkey's unlikely to back down.
That was Martin Patience at the Turkey-Syria border. The United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres has expressed deep concern about the situation in Syria, saying a de-escalation of the conflict is absolutely essential. At a UN Security Council meeting in New York, European nations demanded that the Turks halt their offensive. The Secretary General of NATO, Jens Stoltenberg, called for restraint.
I count on Turkey to show restraint to ensure that their actions in northern Syria are measured and proportionate and avoid even more human suffering.
Meanwhile, Norway has suspended all new arms exports to Turkey, a fellow NATO member. Earlier, the Turkish leader Recep Tayyip Erdogan said that if the EU labelled Turkey's operation an invasion, he would send millions of Syrian refugees currently in Turkey to Europe. Tim Franks spoke to Mohammed Hassan from what's called the Autonomous Administration of North Syria. He's in the town of Armuda, a short distance from the current fighting.
The SDF, the Syrian Democratic Forces, responded to these attacks by Turkey, but the heaviest fight is in Serekaniye and Tel Abyad, in this border strip, where, of course, the Turkish army and its affiliated groups are trying to occupy.
And in terms of how that fight is going between the Kurdish-led Syrian Democratic Forces and the Turkish military and their allies, it's a pretty unequal fight, isn't it? Because presumably the SDF simply does not have the sort of weaponry that is available to the Turkish military.
You are right. Turkey is now using the warplanes and artillery tanks, the heavy and sophisticated weapons.
The Turkish side says that they simply want to establish what they call a safe zone, that they want to push back forces whom they see, these Kurdish forces, as too closely aligned to the PKK, the banned Kurdish group inside Turkey. If that is the case, would it not be better simply for the Kurdish members of the Syrian Democratic Forces to pull back in order to avoid there being a conflict?
First of all, I mean, the SDF are distinct than the PKK. The SDF is composed, half of them, from the Arabs. And even the Kurds in the SDF, they are, you know, Syrian Kurds. Maybe they share some kind of ideological link with their brothers in Turkey. But on the ground, there is no coordination or there is no link at all between the SDF and YPG and the PKK.
Harun Aman is a member of Turkey's ruling AK party and former vice chair of human rights for the party. Tim Franks asked him if he can name a single country that supports the current Turkish offensive.
First of all, I'm very disappointed to see that BBC, a credible broadcast organization, BBC, is actually having guests from a terrorist organization. The person that you just hosted in your show is actually a spokesperson of a terrorist organization. There is no difference between having a spokesperson of ISIS being as a guest to your program than actually the person that you just had. And it was full of lies. Let me just correct one of them. When he was talking about the SDF has nothing to do with YPG, that's a big lie. And the American coalition partner in Syria, Raymond Thomas, former commander of US, last year in Aspen Security Conference, he just said that I'm just quoting his sentences. He said that Turkey had a problem with YPG because it was linked with terrorist PKK. So we told them to change their name. They just came up with a name that has something democracy inside.
Okay.
This is how we established.
We haven't got unlimited time.
This is how actually they came up with SDF. American commander who actually ordered the SDF to be established is clearly saying that there is no difference between these organizations.
All right, but clearly they're not so unpalatable that the US forces and many Western forces feel that it is worth cooperating with them in the bigger fight against the Islamic State group. Can I just ask you to answer the question that I posed, though? Can you name a single country that supports Turkey's current offensive?
Sure, but Tim, also you should be knowing this fact that terrorists ISIS and YPG actually cooperated in Syria several times.
Rather than us litigating past history, can I just return once again, for the third time, and if I can't get an answer, we'll move on.
But
give me an answer as to the question whether a single country supports Turkey's current offensive in northern Syria?
This is exactly the reason why you cannot trust the terrorist organizations, because they're interested.
Okay, so you're not going to answer that question.
I will answer.
Well, I've given you three opportunities, and I'm still waiting.
It's just important to understand that Turkey has been forced to take action against terrorist YPG.
Right.
Since 2018, there has been over 700 attacks from other side of the border. Only today, there was 2 mortar shells and 6 rockets fired from Syria that actually caused 6 civilians lost their life.
Why do you think those mortars were fired? Do you think it's anything to do with the fact that artillery and airstrikes are pouring into northern Syria?
I'm talking about last 24 months, 700 attacks,
What would you do if there are 700 attacks from the other side of the border? I mean, we're talking about the terrorist organizations whose leaders are charged for drug deals.
Do you think, we haven't got much time left. Do you think it's right that President Erdogan threatens the European Union to send millions of refugees into Europe if they don't shut up about this offensive, having already taken billions of dollars from the EU to help Turkey in the burden that it has with these millions of refugees?
If you handpick sentences from President Erdogan's words, speeches, you can make any conclusion you want to make. But the reality is, President Erdogan clearly stated that there has to be responsibility taken by multiple countries, including European countries. Turkey has carried out two operations in Syria before to secure the terrorist threats, including ISIS and PYD. This is how, actually, first time in Syria, some settlers, some Syrians went back to their country.
Now to Iran. Football fans at a match in the Azadi Stadium in Tehran, and on Thursday, thousands of women were allowed to attend the game. They saw Iran demolish Cambodia by 14-0 in a World Cup qualifier. Women have been barred from soccer stadiums since the Islamic Revolution. Iranian clerics argued that they should be shielded from the masculine atmosphere and the sight of semi-clad men. But football's world governing body, FIFA, recently demanded that they be allowed to attend more freely. This came after a young woman, Saha Khodayari, who had gone to a game disguised as a man, killed herself before an expected jail sentence. These female fans, allowed at the match, spoke of their delight at being able to attend openly.
It's really a very good thing. I hope it will be repeated because women need to come to the stadium for happiness and to support their team.
It's a really good feeling. It's a feeling that can't be described.
Farhanak Hamidi is the BBC World Service Women's Affairs reporter, and she's Iranian.
It wasn't the most exciting match, but it was a historic day for women. You know, for the first time since 1979, they were allowed into the stadium. But we have to keep this in mind, not on equal grounds. Women were allocated a limited number of seats. This is a stadium with around 100,000 people capacity, and women were allocated only 3,500 seats. They were only allowed to buy tickets online, and if they hadn't bought tickets, if they got to the stadium, they weren't allowed to buy tickets at the stadium door and get into the stadium. When I was watching the match, the stadium was absolutely empty. So a lot of people were interpreting this as a deliberate message from authorities. When I was reading the tweets on Twitter, that the authorities are basically telling women, you know, we are telling you, you might demand your rights, but we are the ones that decide what you get.
It's interesting, though, because they had limited numbers of tickets and they all had to sit together. But where they put them was quite interesting because they were behind a goal.
I know. It was really interesting. I was watching the match, you know, just to see how the Iranian state-run TV is going to cover this match. Are they going to mention women? Are they going to show women? So there were no close-ups of women or anything. But 40 minutes into the match, I think Iran had already scored 9 or 10 goals. The commentator had no choice but to actually mentioned that we have women in the stadium as well cheering the Iranian national team because the women were seated right behind the Cambodia goalpost.
And what about the men who were at the match? How many men were there, and were they welcoming of the fact that there were women attending?
I think they wanted to show some respect to the women as well because they know they have been witnessing the fight for the symbolic right. You know, in the past 2 years alone, 40 women have been arrested for protesting and for campaigning. And one has set herself on fire, which basically changed the whole ball game. So, yes, the atmosphere was one of support. You could see it both outside of the stadium, men videoing women, showing their support, posting it on Twitter, and also inside the stadium. Apparently, there were reports from within, inside inside the stadium that men weren't cursing as much like they do before. A sense of respect for the women who finally got the right to somehow get into the stadium.
The BBC World Service Women's Affairs reporter, Farinaka Mehdi. Still to come in this podcast.
Usually my commute takes at most 2 hours a day from my home to the school. I drive my own car and I travel just, 10 kilometers a day.
The problems of commuting in the Philippines capital, Manila, voted the world's worst place to drive. The Irish Prime Minister, or Taoiseach, Leo Varadkar, has said he can see a Brexit deal being done by the end of October. It would be concluded after a key European Union summit, but before Britain is due to leave the EU. Mr. Varadkar called talks in northwest England with his British counterpart Boris Johnson very positive and very promising. He stressed that any agreement must avoid a customs border in Ireland and enjoy democratic support in Northern Ireland, where the British government's allies, the DUP, reject any form of separation from the rest of the UK. Here's our assistant political editor, Norman Smith.
After more than 3 hours closeted away together, there was no sign Boris Johnson and Leo Varadkar had managed to secure a dramatic last-gasp breakthrough in the negotiations. However, both sides appeared determined to keep the talks going, and the Taoiseach in particular struck a distinctly optimistic note. Significantly afterwards, there were no recriminations, no finger-pointing, no blame game. Instead, both sides seemed keen to present the talks in a positive light. In a joint statement, both governments said they could see a pathway to a possible deal. What that might be was not clear. Indeed, there were no details or specific proposals. However, it appears the meeting itself was a good deal more constructive and cordial than might have been expected. The two men, who met away from the media in a private country manor on the Wirral, even spent some time walking the grounds together without officials, locked in intense discussion. And at a news conference, Mr. Varadkar said the talks had been very promising, but he declined to give any details about possible concessions made by either side.
We agreed not to get into the details of any proposals or discussions made. But on the timeline question, I think it is possible for us to come to an agreement, to have a treaty agreed to allow the UK to leave the EU in an orderly fashion and to have that done by the end of October. But there is many a slip between cup and lip and lots of things that are not in my control.
It's understood much of the discussion centred on the two key sticking points of customs controls and the role of Stormont. Afterwards, British officials privately were a good deal more cautious and warned against any suggestion there'd been a sudden turnaround in either side's position. In public, however, the Minister for No-Deal Planning, Michael Gove, struck a more positive note.
The conversation between the Prime Minister and Leo Varadkar, they were cordial, they were constructive, they were open, and they say that there's going to be progress. So I'm delighted. We all want a deal. I have to prepare for every eventuality, but I'm hopeful, following the good conversation that they had, that we can make progress in the days ahead.
Given his uncompromising rhetoric and the political strength of the Brexiteers within the Tory party, the Prime Minister's scope for any significant compromise would seem distinctly limited. And with the EU summit now just a week away, the prospect of a last-minute deal would still seem remote.
That was our assistant political editor, Norman Smith. Now, you might have heard me mention before another excellent BBC podcast called Brexit Cast, in which Chris Mason, Laura Koonsberg, Katia Adler and Adam Fleming thrash out the sometimes fast-moving and complicated Brexit-related news and help us make sense of it. Now, just as Batman made a movie with Superman and Alien met Predator, Brexit Cast and the Global News Podcast will be getting together soon too for a Global Brexit Cast, when the Fantastic Four, sticking with the theme there, will be answering your questions from around the world about how it might work, what the sticky issues are, the impact for countries outside the UK, or anything else that has been puzzling you. We don't know exactly when we're going to be recording it yet because things keep happening, but it will be at some time before the end of the month, so do please send us your questions to globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk, or you can always tweet me using the hashtag globalnewspod. Commuting, particularly if you don't have a good podcast to listen to, can be a bit of a struggle. Manila, for instance, the capital of the Philippines, has been voted the world's worst place to drive. Earlier this week, Salvador Panelo, the spokesman for the president of the Philippines, infuriated commuters by saying that if they wanted to arrive early for work, they should just set off earlier. Now he has accepted a challenge to use public transport to commute to work. He says he'll use trains and buses to travel to work at the presidential palace on Friday. Divya Arya spoke to Felipe Salvosa, a journalism lecturer at the University of Santo Tomas in Manila and editor of the news website Press One PH.
Usually my commute takes at most 2 hours a day. From my home to the school.
2 hours? That's a long time. Yeah. How do you go? Like, is it public transport? Is it private transport?
I drive my own car and I travel just, 10 kilometers a day to 14 kilometers a day. And it takes at most 2 hours.
And
because
what?
Of the heavy traffic in Metro Manila.
And are there, like, enough options of public transport in Manila, or do you have to resort to taking your own car?
In Metro Manila, we have a twin crises, no? We have a crisis in traffic congestion because of lack of planning in the metropolis. In Manila roads, the private cars, public transport, and the lorries, they take the same road, okay? And then we have a crisis in mass transportation. There are not a lot of mass transport options available. And these two crises are interrelated, you know, because of the lack of mass transport, people buy cars. And actually, in the last few years, more cars have been bought because of the popularity of ride-hailing apps, no? Which is a more expensive option, no? The thing
ride-hailing
is,
apps.
In the Philippines, it's Grab. So it's very popular here because there are not a lot of mass transport options available. We do have three overhead railway systems, but all of them are crowded. You know, they serve a combined 1.5 million passengers every day. And the bus transport system is fragmented. Unlike in countries in Europe, like in London, there are only one or few owners of bus systems.
That was Felipe Salvosa. The World Health Organization estimates that mental health issues such as anxiety and depression cost the global economy $1 trillion a year in lost output. Thursday was World Mental Health Day. So do companies have a role in taking care of their employees' mental health? Business leaders recently attended the Mad World Summit, a conference about mental health at work in central London. They included Ian Stewart, the UK CEO of the global bank HSBC. So why is it important for his bank to look after the mental health of its staff?
I think it's been one of these things that's been hidden away for a long time, and it does have a big impact on your business. When you start to look at absenteeism and, you know, people not being at their best, it has a really big impact on your customers, on your financial performance, and just on the very well-being of your organisation. So we've got to be really careful because we are really bad at setting deadlines. So as an example, if I'm in a meeting and I say, I'm worried about this, suddenly 50 people are out trying to calm my anxiety against this worry. I probably needed one statistic and I'd be okay, but we've set off a huge piece of work. So understanding some of the behaviours that then trigger pressure points and anxiety in work is really important.
One person who knows all about the cost of poor mental health is Paul Farmer. He is CEO of one of the UK's leading mental health charity and campaign groups, Mind.
We know that the cost of failing to address mental health in business is colossal. In the UK, it costs between £33 and £42 billion a year, about $50 billion. And around about 300,000 people fall out of work every year as a result of poor mental health. So that's a huge cost to workplaces and to individuals. Behind those numbers, though, are the lives of talented, able contributors who often just slide away from the workplace because they don't get the right help and support for their mental health.
That was Paul Farmer of Mind. And now to someone whose mental health has become the foundation for her livelihood. Ruby Wax is an American comedian, author and mental health campaigner who suffers from depression. These days, she regularly gives speeches to businesses about mental health in the workplace. And she spoke to Manuela Zaragoza.
Sometimes I talk about depression because it's a disease, and they feel relieved that I explain what it looks like. It's not stress, it's a sickness. They need medication. This is like Alzheimer's, and you don't yell at somebody to remember where the key is. It's a disease. But then I talk about stress, which is more people, and they really want to know how to deal with rage, how to deal when they're burning out, who do they talk to, what if their kids have it or their coworker, what do they do? And so I try to give them the tools.
You worked when you were unwell. You never stopped working, did you?
I didn't stop working until I was dismissed. But I never told anybody I had mental health problems. I kept that really quiet. In the beginning, I had it once every 5 years. And so I'd have to hide myself. And my husband would say I was in a coma, you know, whatever, because you can't move. And then if you don't take the right medication, then I had it more and more. And I did get caught that I wasn't mentally well.
I like that you say got caught.
You know, it shows in your work. You can't fake this one. You know, you start making the wrong decisions. You can't think straight. You get angry. Somebody should have looked at my glassy eyes and said, you need a doctor. But of course, nobody knows how to spot it. Then I wrote my own shows and now nobody can fire me.
But what advice would you give when people hear about you and they see that you soldiered on through this terrible time? You've come out the other end, but you know, for someone who is in a situation...
Oh, I still have depression.
You still have depression. Is it, how are you now?
Oh, I'm good. I mean, I do practice CBT and mindfulness. It's not a miracle cure, but I know how my mind works, and so I'm vigilant. I check in like you check the weather. Once you see something coming, you have time to shut down social media and get yourself away from people. And so 6 years ago, it passed after 5 days rather than 5 months. It's still as bad as it is, but I haven't had it since.
That was Ruby Wax. A Japanese university student has been given a top grade after handing in what looked like a blank sheet of paper, but there was more to the essay than could be seen at first because she had written it in invisible ink using an ancient ninja technique. Ninjas were covert agents or mercenaries in feudal Japan. Lee McCauley reports.
Amy Haggart's class on ninja history was asked to write an essay about a visit to a famous ninja museum in Japan. Her professor said that there would be extra marks on offer for their creativity. That gave the 19-year-old an idea based on her lifelong interest in ninjas, the secret agents and assassins of medieval Japan. The technique she used is called a buridashi. She soaked soybeans overnight, crushed them and squeezed them with a cloth. This soybean extract was then mixed with water. This part of the process alone took Amy 2 hours. Writing with this ink on thin Japanese washi paper, her words became invisible as they dried. The essay was handed in with a note telling her professor to heat the paper. He was so impressed that it got full marks. He didn't even read the whole thing.
That was Lee McCauley. And that's it from us for now. But there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you would like to comment on this edition or you would like to send a question for the Global Brexit cast, do please send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. No invisible ink, please. I'm Jackie Leonard, and until next time, goodbye.